space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast, talking about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Clay, how are you?
I'm good. I'm stabbing at you from the heart of hell.
a lot of very flowery language here that I think Khan has appropriated, probably from that collection of books on his bookshelf, which he's been reading for 15 years or whatever it is.
I wish that I can only hope that Khan in this movie is an accurate depiction of what happens to you after so much bottled up anger. Like, eventually you get past like fury and whatnot, and then it just turns into like
wrath.
like poetry. Yeah, like when you hit the wrath level, it's like you turn into like a poetic genius.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's just like really more interested in the theatrics of vengeance than the act itself.
Right, yes. It's a lot of clenched fists with a glove over it, sort of raised at the screen of everything like that.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about The Wrath of Khan, directed by Nicholas Meyer, produced by Robert Salin. Screenplay goes to Jack B. Sowards, uncredited credit goes to Nicholas Meyer. And this came out back on June 4th, 1982. This is the one where Khan comes back from Space Seed, and a lot of stuff happens in Spock.
I think you can say this is the one.
This is the one. This is peak Star Trek. It's the movie that's credited with saving the franchise. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to take a break. I'm going to play an audio clip. And me and Clay are going to come back and break down Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Slow to one half impulse power. Let's be friends.
Slowing to one half impulse power.
Reliant in our section, this squadron, sir. And slowing.
Sir, may I quote General Order 12 on the approach of any vessel when communications have not been established?
Lieutenant, the Admiral is well aware of the regulations.
Aye, sir.
Is it possible that comm systems fail?
It would explain a great many things.
They're requesting communication, sir.
Let them meet static.
They're still running with shields down.
Of course. We are one big happy fleet. Ah, Kirk, my old friend. Do you know the Klingon proverb that tells us revenge is a dish that is best served cold? It is very cold. Space.
Ignoring everything else we just mentioned and a little bit of it opening, it's actually nice that this is the very first Star Trek movie to come out, right? There's no Star Trek movie that came out before Star Trek II. I don't know why they called it Star Trek II Wrath of Khan, but it's definitely the very first Star Trek movie. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's like how Evil Dead 2 is kind of basically a reboot and a remake and a sequel of the first Evil Dead. So to the point where I had a friend who actually didn't believe that Evil Dead 1 existed.
Yep.
It's kind of the same thing.
I think it's exactly the same thing, because what's interesting to me on like a big level is how this movie just basically eliminates the need for you to think about the motion picture.
Yeah.
In any way. It was made by Nicholas Meyer and Herb Bennett. Herb Bennett was the producer, both of whom had never really watched Star Trek before they were given the job. So they did a binge watch of the series, and they came out with Herb Bennett decided he liked Khan and he wanted to make a movie about him. And then Nicholas Meyer just knew the basic character interactions and went off as if the motion picture never happened, because this movie starts off exactly like how the motion picture starts off. You know?
Yeah.
In terms of Kirk, the same setup is in place where Kirk is an admiral and promoted outside of his comfort level, and he's sort of upset with how he's aged and how time is passing by and he's no longer in his peak and he can't be out there exploring the stars in a starship.
Yeah, they kind of take a lot of the stuff that I think they were going for in the first one and do it way better.
Right.
Because in the first one, they didn't care about any of that stuff. They just, it was like they wrote down, all right, this is where this is our character, Captain Kirk, and this is where he is in his life. He's sad that he's old. Okay, moving on. Whereas in this one, they actually take the time to explore all of what that means to him and all that kind of stuff much more effectively. And I have to say, they don't entirely act as though the first one never existed, because they use a lot of footage from the first movie.
Yes, yeah, they do. There's a budget saving. There's a lot of shots of the shots of the Klingon ships is taken directly from that. I'm pretty sure the scene where the shuttlecraft docks with the Enterprise is the same thing. But yeah, this is it was a movie that was produced for a fraction of the budget of the first one. I think the first one was $46 million. This one is like $11 million, something like that. New production team. Gene Roddenberry was kicked outside of the thing. Everything. It's really the only situation I started to feel bad for Gene Roddenberry. Apparently, he started writing a whole bunch of scripts as like potential sequels to the motion picture and would chime in with opinions. And almost every opinion he gave was basically met with the production team decided not to proceed with his idea.
Right.
Makes me feel a little bit bad because it is his baby, but at the same time, he
George Lucas effect.
Yeah, he doesn't really know the harm that he's doing to it. So it's a whole bunch of new creatives in this one.
I find that really fascinating. I mean, I kind of don't because I kind of understand it. But I don't know. There's something real interesting about the idea that the creation only reaches its maximum potential once you remove the creator from the equation.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Like, I don't know if that's because with the first one he was more interested in the harder sci-fi aspects or something, but it's like there's that concept of death of the creator that people talk about a lot when it comes to art, where it's like regardless of what the intention was of the person who made it, what it becomes afterwards is what it really is. Like there's a I think we talked about this briefly on the Prisoner podcast, but there's a story about someone at a confronting Ray Bradbury about all of the anti-censorship messages and all this kind of stuff that was in Fahrenheit 451, and he said, "Oh, I mean, I wrote it as because I didn't like TV,
right?
You know, yeah. and it's what people drew from it is different than what his intention may have been, and I think Star Trek is a real big, you know, supporter of that, because we've talked about it many times where Roddenberry is a great conceptualist, but story wise, he's not very good."
Yeah,
he basically has one story, and that's like, oh, what if they meet God?
Yes, he loves that storyline. He's a bit too ideological with his perception of the things, and I think that a big part of the death of the creator sort of idea is that the creators kind of, I mean, they sort of see their productions as their children in a sense, and that it's hard for them to see the flaws or ways that it would actually be better. And someone who can come in and have a fresh perspective on it actually is like, well, you know, this works, but this is really terrible. Like, we should maybe get rid of this idea.
It's like a certain point where even though you created it, what you end up doing starts turning into fan fiction
right.
a little bit.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, especially in Star Trek, you've got this thing where he has this idea that all of Earth is living in harmony. And, of course, that takes out any sort of conflict, because why would you have conflict if everybody's living in harmony?
Yep.
And what he ends up writing these stories where it's like you have to find some other drama, because the drama between the characters is like Kirk and Spock, they're friends. And then McCoy's here, and they're also friends.
Yes.
You know, and so you don't get into the really interesting stuff. Like, he forgets that humans are still human. And as much as it's really cool to go and explore space and all of these out there concepts, you can't do that if you don't relate to the people who are going through the story.
Right, yeah.
And so that's when you get into the really interesting stuff, like that they put forth in this one, where it's like, all right, Starfleet is this idea that, you know, everybody's multi-planets working together for the greater good, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody thinks that they're good or everybody thinks that they're not just a military organization.
Right.
Which is where Marcus and Karl Marx and David are kind of positioned, because David thinks they're a military organization that are just trying to, you know. So that sort of thing lends itself to a lot more interesting stories instead of just like, oh, yeah, I know everyone's friends.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way that they got around the sort of idea that humans are – everyone's all friendly with each other and humanity is pretty much perfect and everything is that in the show, the characters would stumble upon a situation, right?
Yeah.
Like they would be introduced to a situation, and that works for – you know, some episodic television type aspect. It actually lends itself to what I think is one of the funnier, weirder issues about this movie is that, right, they're developing a Genesis program because they're like, you know, we need more planets that can support life. When in the series, they didn't go a single day without discovering a new planet that could support life. So I don't know why they think there's a shortage of these things. But,
yeah. Also, the science behind – well, obviously the science is
sketchy,
wonky, but – but, like, the one thing I noticed this time that had never occurred to me is, like, they're – when they go down to the planet SETI Alpha 5, because they – Carl, they find something. It looks like it's a totally dead planet except for a certain signature. But for whatever reason, their scanners can't determine that it's not a microbe. It's, like, eight people.
Yeah.
And on top of that, Karl Marcus says, if there is as little as a microbe or a molecule – this isn't going to work. The minute they go down to that planet, they've contaminated the planet.
Right. Yeah. That's
they can't use the planet because whatever was on their suits is going to get – and they take their helmets off. Like, so they're contaminating that planet the minute they set foot on it.
And why – I mean, there must be those little eel things down there too, right?
Like, right, yeah.
Those exist down there, but apparently they weren't sensing it. Yeah.
But I'm just talking like in concept, right?
Yes,
like,
yeah,
let's say SETI Alpha 5 wasn't there. And it was a different planet, and they think it has like a microbe on it or something. The minute they go down to the planet, they void the entire planet.
Yes, it's sort of similar to the Signs. I think of it as similar to the movie Signs thing, the Mel Gibson thing, where it's like, yeah, you didn't know that water would hurt you. It's like you didn't know that you'd bring down some bacteria the minute that you got down there, and you couldn't actually use the Genesis weapon.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that shit doesn't matter because who cares?
Right.
if you want to be a real nerd about it, well, yeah, you could.
I mean, quickly, why do you think that it matters? Do you think that the life is a – I thought that what she was saying is that it's like unethical for them to use it on something that's not totally dead.
Oh, you know, I guess I thought it was more of like a
– it would fuck up the way that it works.
Yeah, like it would be a you need like an entirely blank slate in order for it to activate in its peak performance or something like that.
Yeah,
and so you don't want to end up with like a Brundlefly planet or something.
Right, yeah. I don't know. I don't think they ever explain why they can't do it. So it's one of those two things. And interestingly, she's not really Starfleet, so I don't know if she would have the sort of Starfleet ethos about these things. But yeah, Star Trek II. The Wrath of Khan, which is a great title. I guess Meyer didn't like it, but I like the Wrath of Khan.
It's a great title.
It's a good title. It's we bring back Khan, Noonien Singh, who we were both sort of surprised when we watched Space Sea that they would bring him back in any sort of way.
Mm.
They do bring him back here, and they bring him back in a very personal story that picks off right where the motion picture started up, where Kirk is an admiral. He misses the life. Spock is captain of the Enterprise. The Enterprise is apparently used for training missions at this point in its career.
Mm-hmm.
And Khan gets off the planet that he was marooned on through what I consider to be slightly convoluted logic of they put him on a planet and another planet blew up and then they got confused whether it was the fifth or the sixth planet in the system. And they go down and... That's a little bit clunky, but they had to get him off the planet somehow. Then they have a space fight, and Spock dies, and the movie ends. How do you want to talk about this one? You had started in the intro saying that this is the best of the best. Any thought? Did that change for you over this past rewatch or anything like that?
No. Because... And I'm only saying this based on my recollection of the rest of them, which obviously will be freshened once we start watching them, but they do everything right in this one that they did wrong in the first one. And I don't think they ever hit it quite as hard as they do in this one. I think in the later ones, you get more of the side characters and stuff. Like, I think 3 and 4, you get a lot more Sulu and Scotty and Uhura and stuff. But, what we talked about for motion picture, the main thing missing from this, from the motion picture, were the characters. There was no relationship that mattered with the characters. You know, you had your Trinity that was clearly there in the show that was completely absent, to the point where even, like, they write Spock specifically like he doesn't give a fuck about anybody.
Yep.
And this one, almost from the get-go, corrects that. You have, after you have your opening scene with the Kobayashi Maru test, which I think is kind of, it's a very aggressive training mission.
It is, yeah. I always wonder about the Kobayashi, how the legend of it doesn't spread. Like, there must be, once someone passes the test, they must go tell everyone beneath them, be like, hey, there's no solution to the test. Like, don't worry about it, kind of a thing. I wonder how they keep the secret of the Kobayashi Maru, like what the test actually entails, how they don't prevent it from being spread out to the new cadets.
Yeah. And what I think is funny about that is I feel like later, if they had just waited a couple years, the Kobayashi Maru test would have been a holodeck thing.
Yes. Yep.
And which would have made a lot more sense, instead of like, okay, Uhura, you're going to be working the Kobayashi today. You're going to get the panel is just going to blow up right in front of your face.
Yeah, it requires a lot of acting. And from someone like Spock, who I would think that acting he would consider illogical or something, he certainly goes into it.
Yeah. So that whole thing is weird. I know it's done that way, is to be like a misdirect, yes, and make it look, or whatever.
Yep.
But it leads into the introduction of Kirk that you should have gotten in the last one. I don't even remember how he shows up in the first one. I think he just kind of walks on.
He's on the shuttle in Starfleet Command. He gets off like the little shuttle bus.
Yeah, he gets off the train.
Yes, yeah, he gets off the train.
And in this one, you've got your wall opens up and you've got like a nice blue backlight as he. It's awesome. It's really great.
Yep.
But then immediately after that, you've got a scene with Spock, which is great, where they talk about being friends and, Kirk's birthday and getting old. And then immediately after that, you have another scene with Bones where they talk about basically the same thing. In Kirk's room that's apparently filled with, like, millions of dollars worth of priceless antiques.
Right, yes. And but Bones gives him reading glasses for his birthday. Because
cheapskate.
He's an old man, and this is all heading towards that that understanding that you're getting older.
And apparently LASIK surgery doesn't exist in the 23rd century.
No, it's passé.
But you immediately get the relationship of these characters, if not all three at the same time, their relationship to Kirk in a way you do not get in all 137 hours of the first movie.
No, it's like a shocking juxtaposition what they do here, where the first, it really highlights how little characterization there is in the first movie, the motion picture. This movie completely flips that around, and it was shocking to me that it's coming from a creative team that's not particularly obsessed with Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they seem to understand that the people want to see this relationship between these people, and it's also they have a warmer relationship in this movie that makes more sense considering that they're all a little bit older now and they're not exactly tied to the chain of command that they were before.
Right.
So the Spock and Kirk relationship is a little bit more friendly than it was in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it all sits properly for like the setup of the movie feels like this is how the first movie of this series should have been. Like this is the situation with everybody.
Yeah, and I think the way that they set those relationships up work really well. I mean, they're important, given the events of what happens later in the movie. Those relationships are key to the emotional through line of the movie. And it's, I think, one of the other smart things that they do is even though it's technically an ensemble movie, it's really about Kirk.
Yes.
And in a way that the show and the first movie never really were, and it allows you to kind of see all of the action through Kirk's point of view to an extent, not explicitly, but more or less.
Yeah.
and allows you to allows them to relate everything to him in a way that they really haven't done before at least at length.
Yeah.
Even like the thing with his son, you know, I know people write off that character and they literally write him off in the next movie. But there's no father and son like subplot in this movie, and I don't think there's supposed to be.
No.
Because it's not about a father and son story. David is there as a representation of the choices that Kirk has made and the choices that Kirk could have made, and the way that he's looking back as he's getting older. It's all part of that whole thing. So, I mean, the fact that they only have kind of one or two scenes together, I think, is perfectly fine. And I think David serves his purpose really well.
That's interesting, because I actually think that David's role is to – David ties into the fact that Kirk ends the movie by basically growing up and, like, accepting that – like. Accepting the fact that he's a father and he's going to take responsibility for, you know, his kid is grown up by this point, so it's not like he has to really change anything, but he acknowledges the fact that he's a father, and he also comes face to face with, he has that great scene about, he talked about he cheated death for a long time, but he never really understood what it meant.
Right.
And the reason I think that this movie is really great, and I think this will be a good discussion, because I feel like this discussion is less about the nuts and bolts of what this movie is, and it's more about the fact that my main problem with the original series as a whole is that it never really embraced the themes that it was talking about. Like, even on an episode-by-episode basis, it was never really interested in what the episode was about as much as the swashbuckling mechanics of how you get to the end point.
Right.
And this is the most thematic Star Trek content that, you know, if you're going chronologically, that they'd ever done to this point, because it's actually made by filmmakers, you know, to an extent. So they understand that they have to have a story. But I mean, the themes, correct me if or add anything you want here, but the themes here are about death, growing old, and like resurrection, basically, like the sort of rebirth aspect.
Yeah.
And
I would say also, though, I mean, it's probably a subset of the growing old thing, but there's definitely a dealing with the choices that you've made in your past.
Right. Like,
you know, as everybody knows by this point, I'm a sucker for consequences. I think consequences are the, you know, number one or number two most important things in a story. And this entire movie is based on the consequences of Kirk's actions.
Yes. In terms of
marooning Khan on that planet, and also, you know, choosing to not be part of David's life. And so, like, it's a lot of things that kind of, all of the choices he's made up to this point are sort of like coming to a head at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a really, I mean, it's the purest of a character arc that the Kirk character has ever had. I mean, it's about him. It's about him getting old. Death doesn't happen to him, but it happens to his, basically you'd consider it his other half, right? The Spock is the, if you were to combine the two characters into one whole character, that would kind of make sense, because Kirk is the humanity aspect of it, and Spock represents the sort of logical, sort of rational perspective of everything.
Right.
So one half of himself dies in this story. And he comes to the realization that, you know, he never really faced death. He cheated it this entire time, and he was sort of just a boy not understanding the world, and now everything's changed for him. And it's a wonderful through line of him being sort of regretful at the start about the way things have gone, to sort of more of an acceptance at the end of it of the way that everything has gone and the way that life is going to be for him going forward.
Yeah, I think this is the first time that Kirk has ever thought about the stuff that he's done extensively.
Because you could argue that, right? Like, there's almost a point to be made about, why didn't anyone go back to check on Khan? Khan opens this up by saying that he's angry at Kirk for sort of betraying him and never coming back to check on them, because, you know, they had this catastrophic thing on their planet. They lost the ability to have food and everything like that. And he's kind of got a point. Like, why?
Yeah.
In the episode of Space Seed, Kirk actually tells him that they'll be there to sort of support him in this new endeavor.
Right.
And apparently he went back on his word at that point. So it's kind of the consequence of Kirk not following through on what he was supposed to say.
It's like when, you know, you get your friends with somebody and you haven't seen them in a while. And it's like, hey, how's it going? Oh, we should totally hang out. I'm definitely going to, you know, I'm definitely going to call you to hang out. But then, you know, you got kids.
And you got stuff going on. You got
a job. And, you know, sometimes you just want to stay home.
Yep.
And it just doesn't happen.
You at least got to just send them.
Sometimes you maroon someone on a planet for 15 years and you just can't find the time. You know, it's like an hour away.
You just got to send Kirk didn't even send the vague text message of something came up. I can't check on you in City Alpha 6.
If you look at Kirk's communicator, are there a bunch of like you up texts from Khan at like 12 p.m. or 12 a.m. across the 15 years?
Unread. He just swiped it to get rid of the little red notification to get rid of that thing and heads on. Yeah, and you know, something that's interesting outside of this is that we were both surprised that they would bring Khan back, going from Space Seed, that Khan would have such an impact. Mm-hmm. Khan is not really in this movie all that much, and he and Kirk never actually have a face-to-face.
Yeah, it's like Heat.
Yes.
Only on a spaceship.
Right. They don't even meet in a diner in the last 10 minutes, though, to talk about how you gotta leave if you feel the heat coming around the corner. And I think that's interesting. And it's also, I think there's a change between getting older. The movie, to me, is no longer about Khan in a way. Like,
yeah.
In a way that young me sort of thought that this was the great Khan vengeance story. It's not really about that. He's not that. I mean, he is influential on the story, but he's not the main driving sort of focus of what the movie is trying to talk about.
No, I mean, like I said, it's Kirk's actions, and Khan and his vengeance are a consequence of Kirk's actions. And Khan doesn't really need to do that much because what he does is enough. You know, I do like, however. They do give Khan that sort of like Melvillian Moby Dick kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I like more what they do with him. Well, I guess it's part of that thing. But there's a scene. You only get really one scene or two scenes where Khan isn't just like monologuing or you know spitting fire at Kirk,
yep.
Which he does fantastically, I might add. And it's when they're on the bridge of the ship. And I can't remember if they've damaged the Enterprise or what, but Khan's second in command there is like, dude, we've won. We've got a ship. We can go anywhere we want. Basically everything he wanted in the space seat, he now has.
Right, yes, yeah.
And he's like, let's just go. We can go wherever we want. You've won. Let's get out of here. And it's Khan's pride that stops him from doing that.
Yeah,
it's his desire to get even that stops him from doing that. And I think that's a level of explaining the motivation, or it's a level of giving motivation to a revenge character that you don't really get very often.
Right,
where he's actually it's actively, and it comes back to bite him too, because that's how Kirk beats him. He plays on his pride, you know. Khan is slowing down as they're going into the nebula, and Kirk totally fucks with him. He's like, oh, I didn't realize you're such a big pussy.
Right.
And then he comes yeah. That's when he juices it up and goes after him. So it's like they're at least as Kirk says, he's nothing if not consistent.
Right. Yeah, it's it is very Ahab-y, his sort of turn here. I mean, I like the fact that they sort of represent the Khan desperation by they're no longer wearing their sort of neat little jumpsuits from Space Seed. You know, they've been on this planet, obviously, for a while. So they're
right.
They're more sort of savages at this point. And the...
It's a great foreshadowing of seven seasons worth of ruffian clothing on TNG where they all dress like they're from the Warriors,
right,
for some reason.
Right, yeah. The what's sort of interesting to me is that in Space Seed, the genetic Superman aspect was a very important part. Here, the only thing I think that it ever comes through is when he picks up Chekhov by the neck. That's like
right.
That's the only time that him being genetically superior is ever really important or ever has any kind of impact on it. And I think it's neat that the desperation of what Khan and his followers have become is portrayed through their sort of, or Khan's one perspective angle on he has to get rid of Kirk. Like, that's the mm-hmm. only goal at this point.
Yeah. I mean, he does it to the detriment of his crew, too. There's only that one dude who you really get to, who has any lines, really. But, I mean, originally in Space Seed, the one thing he wants to do is save his people.
Yes.
And in this one, he does not care. I mean, he does, and he uses it as an excuse. But when that guy gets in his face, he's like, we are set. We could get out of here. And if he does that, he saves the lives of all of the people on his ship. But he chooses to go after to Kirk instead and ends up getting them all killed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a, it's a sort of more desperate version of Kirk, right? Kirk's angle there would be that he would try to get back the ship, right? He would try to get the Enterprise back. He's not as desperate as Khan, but you can see a sort of similar drive in what they're trying to do at the same time. So I think that's why they mirror each other very well. They can see themselves, you know, it's cliche, but they can see themselves in the other, which I think makes for a good villain aspect here. And the Khan angle is interesting. I'm still always surprised that they sort of chose to bring him back. I don't really know why he struck Harv Bennett as like the great character that they need, but
I understand it because if you go back, I mean, watching Space Seed again, it's built for a sequel. Not that that was stuff that people really cared about at the time. I mean, like I don't think they'd ever done that where they'd done a movie sequel based on an episode of a TV show before.
They had not, yeah.
But I mean, you know, Montalban was a star, and so he's a name to put in the movie without doing crazy stunt casting. And I mean, it does lend itself to a sequel, and you've got a star who you can probably get for, if not, he probably cost a decent amount, but he wasn't probably crazy money, as if you were going off after like an A-lister or something like that. And it's a story that, you know, is after a movie that was not related to the show hardly at all. You've got a story that's a direct sequel to the show, so it probably gets the fans back on your side and stuff. So I can understand why they did it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that
the first choice was probably to bring back Clint Howard, though, like the weird baby,
the Wrath of Blaylock or a Baylock, yeah. Whatever that guy's name. I could imagine that. I think that it's just I don't think it's a perfect movie, but it's like extremely well constructed just because, mm-hmm. and it might just be the fact that we're basing it off of the motion picture, which we saw, which is not well constructed whatsoever. And a lot of the TV episodes that we watched through, mm-hmm. but it's like everything kind of makes sense here. I wanted to get your opinion about the Genesis device.
Uh-huh.
The Genesis device clearly would go on to become more important in the movies afterwards.
Right.
What do you think about it in terms of this movie? Like, if you're watching The Wrath of Khan only as itself by a standalone movie, what do you think about the Genesis plotline?
I think it's fine. Okay, so what I like about the Genesis plotline is the Genesis plotline has become a very cliche type of plotline. It's basically the same plot as every Marvel movie that they make, where it's like bad guy is trying to get massively powerful weapon that can destroy planets or the Earth or cities or something, and then they have to stop him from using it. What I like about the way that they do it here, though, is that in the grand scheme of things, it's not really that important.
No, it's
like
not.
It's not like Khan's plan here is to get the Genesis device and then shoot it at Earth and hopefully in the process kill Kirk. It's like getting the Genesis device is just part of his plan to kill Kirk.
Yes. Yep.
I mean, it's like they leave it in the transporter room. They beam it onto the ship, and then they're like, should we put this somewhere? It's like, ah, no, fuck, it's pretty heavy. Just leave it there.
Just we'll beam this thing off. I like it because it's a very... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I also like it because it's not part of the stakes. I mean, it is a little bit, but like the overall stakes and emotional stakes of the movie do not involve the Genesis device.
Right. There's a couple reasons I like it. There's a couple reasons I don't like it. I do like the fact that it does... as it's intended, it ties into the themes of the movie. It's about the rebirth. Like, they're literally rebirthing a planet to something else. And I like the fact that it's very Star Trek-y in that it's not designed to be a weapon.
Right.
It just has that capability of being a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very strong fit. Apparently, the original drafts, it was supposed to be like basically a huge nuclear bomb that he goes after. And they decided that that was not fitting with what the series was about.
Yeah,
and
that's a good call.
Yeah, I think it's a smart choice to do it. My problem with it is that it obviously will go on to tie into the search for Spock in particular. But it takes up a lot of screen time for something that's not particularly important to this story. Outside of introducing us to Carol and David Marcus, there's nothing really about this. Like, it's even weird that Khan seeks it out to use against Kirk when it seems like shooting him with a ship was working pretty effectively. It feels like it's almost overkill on his from his angle.
Well, I guess it was more. Isn't it more just to kind of draw Kirk out, really?
Yeah,
well, he goes after it to have it because
Kirk has to respond to it.
Yeah,
yep.
And it's using it as a weapon is sort of just like a. I don't think he ever really intended to do that.
Okay, outside of the suicide at the very end.
Or maybe he used. I don't know. I guess I don't think it's first on his list of to-dos, I guess.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And I think that makes sense. Although I think in my case that would actually knock it further down the. For how much screen time it takes up, it feels a little bit odd that it's in the movie that much at that point.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of, I don't know. I guess like I was saying, I give it a pretty big pass because it's thematically consistent.
It's not the
main MacGuffin. You know, it is kind of a MacGuffin, but not really. It's just sort of just one of the things that happens. It's not super important.
Yes. Yeah.
And the way they use it at the end is nice. It's effective and, you know, sets up the search for Spock for better or worse.
Yes. Yep. No, I like it for basically how thematic that it actually fits into the whole thing, and like the weapon and how it works and everything like that actually makes sense in terms of the context of the overall story.
Like think of that versus the red matter stuff from the reboot there. That's something that is just primarily a world-destroying weapon and isn't really thematically important.
No.
It just is like, that's the weapon that the guy's going to use, and we have to stop him to use it before he uses it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking, as I watched this, I had complained in the motion picture that I thought they did too much retrofitting of the Enterprise in the motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie's kind of what I'm talking about. So I wanted to talk about the sort of look of this one compared to everything else. The bridge in this one is what I would expect from the first movie of the series. They basically just updated the TOS bridge, the original bridge. Yeah.
I did notice that. I remember not noticing it as much until you pointed it out in the last show. But so I was looking for it this time. And yeah, it definitely feels more like a traditional bridge.
Even in the small things, on the motion picture, Spock was to the back and right of Kirk. You know, in this one, he's to the back and left, which is where he's always been for the entire series. And obviously, there's a much more severe naval theme in this. Down to the way that they look in their uniforms, there's a bell on the bridge, and they stand at attention a lot more. There's a lot more pomp and circumstance about the officers getting on board and everything like that, which has never been a part of it. But do you think that the naval theme adds anything, or does it kind of change the way that the series was and maybe, in your opinion, should have been?
I like it. I think that one of the things that was sort of lacking in the motion picture was a bit more constraint with how stuff worked. It was just
everyone shouting ideas at
Kirk. And like the chain of command didn't really matter that much and stuff. And that's not supposed to be super important, but I think it needed to be in this movie because this overall is a much more realistic depiction. And I use that term as loosely, I guess loosely, but like for instance. I don't think up until this point we've ever seen a scene in sickbay that they're doing triage because a bunch of engine room workers have like third degree burns.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's, and like there is the fact that Kirk walks around for two scenes with the flap of his jacket open with that like white interior and there's blood smeared all over it. That's definitely a first.
Right.
Like, is there even blood in the show? I don't even know if blood shows up, does it?
Spock has green blood, so we see that.
So no. but, like, you're seeing blood, you're seeing carnage, you're seeing people die. I mean, even when they get phaser blasted, they got to really learn how to dial those phasers down. Because you take one shot with that and you just get vaporized. It's a lot more, the violence and casualties are a lot more relatable and hit home more than they usually do. It's not just, you know, a guy in a red shirt getting hit with a light rock.
Yeah.
And I think all of that, I think if you did that under the umbrella of the kind of more loosey-goosey Starfleet ranking system, it just wouldn't feel right.
Yeah, I feel that I enjoy the chain of command type stuff. I think it adds like sort of a structure to the stories and who does what for what reason. And the way this stuff is brought to Kirk's attention and Kirk being the ultimate decider makes a lot more sense. Where in the series, it was more of he would ask for a bunch of opinions and stuff. This one, they definitely feel more militaristic, which is to David's credit about what he thinks about Starfleet. And it's militaristic in a way that even the show wasn't really that way.
And I think it really helps too for the Kirk character, because I mean, you know, as I talked about a bit when we were doing the TOS, TOS was not really my show. I always had an affinity for the original crew, but it was always from the movies and not the show. And I think, and we also talked about how the preconceptions or the popular misconception of Kirk is that he's just a shit kicker ladies man or whatever.
Yes, yeah.
When he's really not that. And I think this movie is like the best possible version of Kirk, where you've got he's got the charm and the smarminess to him, but when it's time to throw down, he's the guy making the decisions and he's really good at what he does.
Right. And it's a sort of a long-term relationship in a way. You know, it's not a it's not a babe of the week type storyline.
Yes,
he's a little bit too
yeah.
old for that, but it's somebody he has a history with. He obviously had a child with her. They have a very interesting relationship for what's sort of come out of it, and I guess particularly her attitude towards the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The movie doesn't say that he was never asked to be a part of David's life, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so
they basically imply that, you know, she knows that he wants to be a starship captain and she doesn't want him flying all over the galaxy. So
right.
They just chose not to
bring it up,
be part of each other.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's a good aging sort of storyline to bring back and everything like that. But I agree. I think this is probably the best version of Kirk that you could probably get from it. Totally makes sense in terms of the context of becoming the original series guy, like an older version of the original series guy, while also being in a story that makes sense and feels appropriate for him.
Yeah, this Kirk is my Kirk.
Yep.
This is what I think of when I think of Captain Kirk.
So I guess that brings us to we can talk about Spock for a little bit.
Oh, I did want to talk a little bit more about some of the visuals.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Just really quick. Because one of the other things that they do in here that is a big change from the first one is they bring the color back.
Yep.
It's still very 70s. It's still like the reds are like brown reds and lots of, oranges and yellows and browns. And so it's still got that kind of 70s feel to it, but they brought more color back into it. Like even on the ship, the outside of the ship, they added some red. It makes it pop a little bit more. So I think the costumes are a big improvement. I don't know if I love the fact that they all wear the same thing and they just do like the colored collars.
Yeah, yeah.
Oddly enough, I like it when they do it later in the TNG stuff, but I think I like it more there because the colored collars are more varied. Like
the
colors are brighter.
Yep.
Whereas here, it's a little bit hard to differentiate what they're trying to go for.
Right, yeah. Yeah, they... Did they have the pips on their communicator at this point? I didn't actually notice. That's the only other way, but it's a very small.
I don't remember.
It's a very small way to tell the difference between them.
They have, I know, on their right shoulder. They've got different symbols depending on rank.
Okay.
I don't think they have anything on the actual Starfleet badge.
Yeah. So I think I kind of agree. The jackets that they wear always feel to me a little bit more like they're sort of high-ranking uniforms that it doesn't make a lot of sense for the captains and lieutenants to be wearing.
Speaking of jackets, that we've covered a lot of field jackets across the TOS in these movies.
Yeah.
The field jacket that Kirk wears in this movie is the best field jacket. 1982, between this and Blade Runner, was a great year for gigantic collars.
It was a good year for the leather bomber jacket type thing.
I want that jacket so bad.
It's iconic. It's memorable. It's on the poster for the movie and all that stuff. It had left such an impression. I think that the look of the film and everything, I think, is... It's not as sort of epic in scale as the motion picture. It feels a little bit more smaller. It feels much more like a submarine, the Enterprise, in this movie than it ever did.
I did notice that the sets are a lot smaller.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, I know that I was very surprised to find out that this... Well, obviously it had less of a budget, but I was surprised to find out that it had a considerably less of a budget. Because... I think this movie's really efficient in what they do and in the sets that they use. And so I don't think it feels that small.
No, it doesn't.
But it definitely is.
I noticed the budget most in the ship battle scenes.
Yes, I noticed that too.
When the worst might be when the Enterprise shoots off the nacelle of the Reliant. It doesn't look very good for whatever reason.
Yeah, it looks like the nacelle is made out of like styrofoam.
Yeah, and it just sort of crumbles off of it. And
they also the exterior shots of like the dogfighting are not super great.
No,
they're not terrible, but it's just like it's kind of like clearly a couple models that they're sort of like just kind of panning past each other. It's not the most exciting thing.
No, it's a stop motion. I think for the actual shooting of it and the stuff like that flies off.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, it's definitely not the storming the Death Star trench.
No, it's that's where I noticed the budget and the special effects. Like, does anyone transport in this movie?
Oh yeah. I actually was keeping my eye open for that because I knew it was a lower budget, and they do it a few times.
Oh, do they? Okay. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Maybe when they go down to the planet, the Genesis planet.
They transport down to SETI Alpha 5, and they also transport down to the Genesis planet, and then they transport the Genesis device out of the planet.
Oh, that's right.
And
yeah,
so
that's
they use it a bunch of times.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't love the fake sandstorm they use.
No, that looks very bad.
Yeah.
Although it's a great reveal of Khan's people.
Oh, yeah. When you say that the scale is a lot smaller in this one, I think what they actually managed to do better is this one has more of an operatic feel than the first one. I think because maybe the themes are so much bigger or so much more emotional.
Yeah.
But, like, you know... even the way that Khan reveals himself, where he's, you know, all geared up, and they have the music swell as he's slowly taking the pieces off. And I mean, Montalban is an actor, a capital A actor.
Right.
So everything he's doing feels like he's on stage, for better or worse.
Yep.
And I think it adds a lot of operatic kind of, oomph to what's going on, which is really happening in like four different rooms.
Right. Yes, exactly. And as you said, it ties into the themes need that little bit of a kick in the pants to carry them through the rest of the movie. The Ahab's tirade is due to the last I grapple with thee, from hell's heart I stab at thee, for hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee. That's his final operatic statement towards Kirk.
You ever wonder, like, if you're going to die, right? And you say something really great. Do you tell people, okay, just say that was my last words? Like, what if you say something awesome and then after that you're like, ah, I pooped myself, you know, or something.
It's the,
you know what
the
I mean?
Monty like, Python, the ah, it's like who would write ah when they die? Or
yeah, but it's just like all these people, I mean, obviously it's from Moby Dick, so it's not an actual last words, but like you hear last words from people that are so like poetic and whatnot. Were those really their last words, or was that what they said before they said something really racist?
Right, or I just shit myself. I can't believe I'm going to die in a puddle of my own filth type
or like,
line.
Susan, you were always a disappointment.
That'd be many people's last words, I think. Yeah, I don't know how the last word thing sort of gets immortalized, whether or not, like, so many of them are profound. I'll be very disappointed if my last words are not particularly profound, I think. I got all this time to think about it. It's not something you put on the agenda at the top of the order, I guess. I think that I guess we can wrap. Well, before we get into Spock, we'll get into Savick. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about Savick? People seem to have thoughts about her, and I don't really. I don't know what else you can say about her.
I think she's fine. I don't know if she's entirely necessary.
Yep.
I don't feel like her character really grows at all. I mean, not that it's her movie to do that, really, but I mean, the position that they put her in usually denotes some sort of change of outlook by the end of the story.
Yep.
And I don't think she gets that.
No.
I'm trying to think of some reason why she would be there.
I mean, she's on the front is that, she's Vulcan, but obviously emotional in this. This is justified, I guess, by she's half Romulan in the script.
Oh, yeah.
I think that just goes to show the fact that it doesn't really matter all that much. It gives Spock a unique perspective because it's another Vulcan that he can talk to.
Yeah, I guess her only real purpose is to put a face on the young crew.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
You know, because she's the only one of this young crew that has any lines. So, and, you know, she gets the position of kind of getting the Daisy Ridley dialogue from Force Awakens, where she's, like, asking the questions about, you know, how did you beat the test and all this kind of, you know, she's kind of the more nostalgic, not explicitly, but that's kind of what she's doing is being the young sounding board that Kirk can tell his old man stories to.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think I'd agree that she's the face of the young crew, which squares off. I think we'll finish the discussion with...
I was just going to say, what is kind of interesting is they don't play her more like a straight Vulcan, because I feel like the opportunity there would be to make her... it would accent the relationship a little bit more between Kirk and Spock, because Spock is supposed to be the logical, pure logical one. So if she's trying to go that route, and like basically an extension of the scene where they get back up under the ship and they find out that they were using coded language, and she looks at Spock and says, "You lied." And he says, "No, I just exaggerated."
Right.
Like that sort of thing, I feel like might have been a bit more effective for a character who was still trying to figure out how basically the real world works. Because so if her character is more straight-laced or a hard-line Vulcan, right, that could be a little bit more of a representation of like someone who's just come out of military school, and so all they've got in their head is the book.
Yes, right.
You know?
Yep.
And so the things that she's saying are all doing it by the book, or, you know, in her case, doing it by the book, plus also being a hardline Vulcan. And so she gets to see through the real-world actions of Kirk and Spock, especially Spock, how that is not necessarily the be-all, end-all of how you handle situations in real life.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Rewrite the movie.
Movie sucks. We're going to rewrite this. Well, let's much like the movie ends, let's wrap up with the death of Spock. Which, I call me crazy, I feel that it's actually not that big of an event in the story to the way that it's remembered. I feel like the scene actually underplays it a little bit.
Yeah, I think they kind of do. I think...
Starting off, it's not particularly clear to me when it starts what Spock is trying to do.
He's trying to stick a fork into the toaster.
Right, basically, I always forget he's trying to repair the warp drive. It doesn't look like a way that you would actually repair the warp drive. I guess it's just he needs to get hit with a dose of radiation. But
yeah,
it's a little bit – I understand what they're trying to do, and I understand thematically what it is. It's almost a case of the theme is strong, but I don't really understand the rationale for getting there, or I don't think that they show the actions of getting to that point and the repercussions all that well.
Well, I mean, the excuse that they use is that he is not human, so he has a higher resistance to the radiation.
Yeah.
So he's the only person that can go in there and fix it. But they don't lean into that a lot. They just sort of have a throwaway line where Bones kind of says it, and then he gets, you know, Vulcan neck benched. I think they handle it pretty well, actually, because, you know, even during the scene where he's dying – and they're talking, there's not like a big music swell or anything. They just allow this scene between these two characters to happen.
Yes.
What I love is how much they actually telegraph it from the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, they do that a lot. Yeah.
Not only because, you know, of the scene where the whole Enterprise blows up, but then the first scene with Kirk and Spock afterwards, Kirk says, "Aren't you dead?"
Yes. Yeah. Referencing the beginning thing.
Yeah. And it's a nice fake out, which comes off as just a joke line, but as, you know, foreshadowing of what happens later.
Yep. Yep.
I guess I would say it is underplayed a bit, but, I don't think it's a detriment to underplay it. 'Cause I think they could have gone, if I remember correctly, it's been a while since I've seen this because I only saw it once and I didn't like it. In Star Trek Into Darkness, I think they go the other way, where it's like a very overdramatic thing.
Yes.
Where Kirk is, you know, big music swell and doing something ridiculous, and then he ends up getting killed for it. so I think – I don't know. I think I've always liked the way that they play it because it's not – it's not like he's hitting the big red button to shut down the machine. He is just sort of doing – he's just doing his job, and he ends up being the one who has to get killed for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that, and like it, everything about it makes sense on a like fundamental level to me. I just people were so upset about it, and that has nothing to do with the way that they did it. But it's a very, I feel like it makes sense in terms of the story. I just feel like it's almost like there's like three lines of dialogue missing from it or something. Like I feel like there should have just been slightly more of a profound goodbye between everybody. Spock really just is like, well, live long and prosper, and then he just kind of curls up and dies, and it's like, well, it was weird. I appreciate the fact that Shatner didn't really over Shatnerize it. They wore him out enough to get through that, but it does feel to me, it feels like the scene is happening with the complete understanding that this is not permanent.
I see what you mean. I don't know, I guess I never really felt that way. I feel like they managed to do here what they tried to do with Tasha Yar later on, where it was just her getting killed in the line of duty sort of thing.
Right.
I feel like they do it a little bit better here.
Because it's actually tied to the story.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, he does what he has to do to save the ship, and then, you know, he just ends up getting killed for it, as opposed to whatever they did, getting blasted in the face by a mud demon.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, like they play off Tasha's death a lot with a lot even less emphasis than they do this, and I think they go too far with Tasha. And this one, I feel like they hit it pretty well.
Yeah, I think that sums up the movie. Well, I think we've done a good job talking about this one. It's been about an hour. And
one thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah, go ahead.
How do you feel about the music? Because they actually, I believe the same composer switch over between Alien and Aliens, they went from Jerry Goldsmith to James Horner.
Oh, did they?
I've always liked the music to this, but I don't, especially having recently bought the soundtrack to the motion picture. That soundtrack is so great.
I feel I saw a lot of people online praising the soundtrack of this one. I don't remember the soundtrack to this movie. I do remember the motion picture soundtrack.
I think Jerry Goldsmith had a harder job than James Horner did, because Jerry Goldsmith had to fill a lot of empty space.
Yes, yeah.
He really hits it out of the park. I think James Horner, I think the music is really good in Wrath of Khan. I just don't think it's quite as at the forefront as it was in the first one.
Yeah, the Goldsmith thing fit the tone of the movie better. I was just reading, apparently the Wrath of Khan one is more navally themed. I never really got that impression from it. It felt more stock in a way, like it was less composed for the movie.
Yeah.
It's not to say that's bad. It's just it didn't strike me as something that's particularly memorable.
Mm.
But anyway, I'm going to give this one a... I'm going to give it a... This is tough. I guess I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
What?
It's a very high... I don't think any of the movies are particularly... I think that this is the best of the Star Trek movies in a lot of ways. And I just don't think it's particularly a transcendent movie. It's a very strong, very good workman type, not workman, but a very strong movie version of what the show could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it succeeds at that in a way that the motion picture utterly failed. I just don't think it's a, I know you've said before that you think it's one of the more classic action movies, and I don't know if I'd put it on that level.
Have I said that?
I think you said that you said it was one of your maybe favorite, you might have said, action movie, something like that.
Sure.
Sure. You say a lot of things on the show.
I do. I say lots of stuff.
What are you going to give it?
I can't give it less than a 5.
Okay.
The last one I said the scale is from a 1 to First Contact, but I think this one is probably, even more than First Contact, is probably a better representation of what Star Trek as a movie would be.
That's true. I think you've on the scale of Star Trek movies, I will give this one a 5 out of 5. I do think it's the best Star Trek movie. There's not a lot wrong with it, really.
No,
I always feel a little bit let. I always feel a little bit like my expectations aren't met by it, if that makes sense. Even though it is a very good movie.
Yeah, I think it's a tough one to go back and look at, especially at this point, because it has been so highly praised for so long that it might not exactly be what you're expecting it to be.
Right.
Because it's not, I don't even know if I'd really call it an action movie, because it's...
No, it's not really action-y.
No, it's... anybody... if you were talking to a Star Trek fan, a new Star Trek fan, and you were like, oh, you got to see The Wrath of Khan, you're going to love it. I don't know if that's entirely true. Because if you're used to the modern Star Trek, which is now just big budget action sci-fi, this movie's very quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's dealing with a lot of stuff that, people might not be into.
Right.
If they go into a Star Trek movie. It's a Star Trek movie about getting old.
Yeah, it's in a lot of ways it's a 80s action movie mixed with the themes, the heavy sort of themes of the 70s, the idea of sort of decay and everything that's sort of prominence in 70s movies.
Yeah, it's a unique opportunity to explore stuff you don't usually explore in these sorts of movies. The best comparison I can think of it is sort of you ever see The Color of Money?
Yep.
Great movie. And it's the same kind of thing where it's a character that you know from a previously existing thing, and only it's 20 years later, and you get to really sit with the ramifications of this person's life and how they've lived and what their point is from going point is going forward. And did Roddenberry not like this movie?
He did not until it was successful. Then he changed his mind.
Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me, but it also kind of does, because I feel like this is all the best parts of the Star Trek idea in one package.
Yeah, yeah. Well, guys, I think Clay summed it up there. Very good Star Trek movie. You should check it out if you haven't seen it. Obviously, I'm sure a lot of you have, or you wouldn't be listening to the podcast, but... thank you very much for watching. If you're on YouTube, like and a comment. Appreciate it. If you're on iTunes, if you could rate us there, rate us on any of the podcatchers. Facebook.com/ThePenskeyPodcast, you can go there. Patreon.com/ThePenskeyFile, you go there, you get extra content. For $2 a month, you get extra podcasts. We just did Miami Vice, going to do Mad Men pretty soon. The pilots. What this movie was missing was some Jan Hammer soundtracks.
What most movies are missing are some Jan Hammer.
And that's about it. Guys, thank you very much for listening to the show. We appreciate it. We're going to be continuing on with the Star Trek movies. It'll be Search for Spock after this one, which, yeah, Clay, what I wanted to do was a video where we it would basically be based off the posters, right? And we sort of rank the posters, but the posters also include the sort of like title and the catchphrase and everything you know, like that, like to list them from the worst to the best. I think that would be kind of an interesting thing, but
that'd be pretty fun.
Would you think that the Wrath of Khan would stand at the top or the bottom for you there, just on terms of the poster and the sort of title and everything like that?
I love the poster for Wrath of Khan. Let me just look it up real quick here.
The phrase is, "At the edge of the universe lies the beginning of vengeance."
That's a great catchphrase.
That is a good great phrase, tagline. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to talk shit about any of these posters because they were all done by Bob Peak, who is one of the best poster illustrators who ever lived. I will say, however, that now I'm looking at Search for Spock. Search for Spock's a pretty good poster.
I don't want to spoil it. I think Final Frontier is probably one of the worst ones. Just on the poster.
Yeah, that goes. I think all around.
I think that the catchphrase for that one is "At the final frontier, you find the beginning of imagination," or something. It's really not. Oof. It's kind of clunky.
Oh, that sounds like that was written by like 15 different people. I don't know. It's hard to hate on the Wrath of Khan poster. It's pretty rad.
It is. It's thematically appropriate. I was thinking of tying in the TNG movies as well. That would be there too.
Yeah, that'll be interesting because all of the TNG posters are like Photoshop.
Yep.
Trying to be Bob Peak posters.
Yes. Yep. Guys, thank you very much for listening. Clay, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is as I've said before, the movies are my wheelhouse for Star Trek. So I'm really looking forward to going through them, especially Star Trek 3, where the budget is increased and the quality is less.
Yes, and it's a nice break from the original series mentality into the movies that I think we all remember these things for. Guys, thank you very much for listening. I'll see you next time.